joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza.
And I can't believe that that is happening.
If this is your first time watching or listening to the show, I want you to know that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show brings on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, even if I forget and leave my phone on. And I'd like you all to do me a really big favor. So please forward one of our shows to your social media group or to someone that you know who can benefit from a particular subject. I want you to know that this is just one way that we can make a powerful difference in the world together. Now, our topic today is health. Now, it's something we talk about a lot on this show, but not what your health insurance carrier will tell you, and certainly not what Big Pharma will share. So, presenting diagnostic insight, specific homeopathic remedies, and successful case study examples about the profound connection between emotions and their physical manifestations in illness. Our guest, Jerry M. Cantor, is a faculty member of the Ontario College of Homeopathic Medicine and the owner of Vital Force Healthcare, a Boston area homeopathy and acupuncture practice. He's the first acupuncturist to receive an academic appointment at Harvard Medical School's Department of Anesthesiology and the author of The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Sane Asylums, Interpreting Chronic Illness, The Toxic Relationship Cure, and Autism Reversal Toolbox. Jerry, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you very much, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it has been my pleasure just reading through your books, learning more about you, learning more about existentialism. So I think to start off with, why don't you share with our audience what that is?
You know, the word existentialism has gotten a lot more currency of late. It used to be kind of an egghead term, I suppose, maybe associated with the hipsters of the 1950s and 60s. But now routinely people are saying climate change is an existential issue. Environmental degradation is an existential issue. Proxy wars, which are proliferating all over the world. Right now we're in the middle of one horrendous one in the Middle East. God help us so it doesn't spread any further. There's a field of psychology called existential psychology, which works with people therapeutically to overcome their issues from the standpoint of meaning. So it doesn't just mean, oh shit, we're all going to die. That's kind of how it's in the popular media. Right. But in psychological terms, it has to do with the search for meaning. And it came out of World War II, of course, when we realized, my God, we had a Holocaust, 6 million Jews killed, many Romani people. I mean, not just horrible things, but intellectually and morally unfathomable. What right. the hell is going on? What does all this mean? What does my life mean if something like this can happen? So what I've done, this last book I've written, which is called the Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Homeopathy for Existential Stress, it's more than stress. It's the deep quandaries of existence that have, you know, questions concerning the meaning of life and in various circumstances. And what I've done here is I have to humbly say I've reformulated existential psychology along the lines of homeopathic philosophy and also that of traditional Chinese medicine. And so what I've done, this is kind of a sequel to my very first book, Interpreting Chronic Illness. Mm-hmm. But I've uncovered five core existential questions that if you can't resolve them, and by the way, existential questions do not have a logical answer. There's not just an answer to it. You say, okay, now I know that. There's something that have the questions which have a deep charge, a tremendous charge, and that can make us sick. Anyway, I've developed or discovered, I think, five core existential questions which are aligned with both the five elements of Chinese medicine, the five classical miasms of homeopathy, and what I call the five senses, and I call the sense-dimensional analysis. So what I've done, and it's the product of quite a bit of work, is to categorize homeopathic remedies as subcategories of these five core questions, and basically showing how if these questions have a big charge for us, they render us susceptible to illness. Mm-hmm. Now, in classical homeopathic terms, the five classical miasms are attached to five diseases which have rampaged through the human population over many generations. And those diseases are syphilis, gonorrhea, tuberculosis, cancer, and something that's called SORA, P-S-O-R-A, which the founder of homeopathy thought was the original disease, and our attempts to suppress SORA, which has to do with itching, a feeling of not being okay in the world, has led to the other miasms. So this is a very big time mind-body book, which shows how, and I can go into what those five questions are, I can tell you what they are, how the failure to resolve the charge of those, and we never completely, no one I've ever met is completely free of the charge of those five questions. In fact, every time you get sick, we go into one of them again. But I can, if you want, go through what those five questions are.
Absolutely. You were reading my mind. That was what I was going to ask.
Yeah, okay. It's deep water, so this is not superficial stuff. And I would say that somebody who's not interested in the deeper questions of life would not be advised to read these books. They would just sort of shrug their shoulders and say, my God, I don't know what to make of this. Anyway, the first existential question is, am I alone in life, or do I act in synchrony with nature and with others? And that ties into, believe it or not, if you're not able to resolve that, in my opinion, at a deep level, that renders you susceptible to tuberculosis. And it ties into the element of fire in traditional Chinese medicine. And at the physiological level, it's about cardiology. It's the cardiological system, our heart, and our arteries, our arteries, and even this the small intestine in Chinese medicine. There's a conundrum that's buried in there, and that has to do with resolving the sense of isolation, and any person interested in existentialism will relate to that, as opposed to being in synchrony. Isolation versus synchrony. So we know when we're isolated, when we feel alone and alienated. When we're in synchrony, we have a strong sense of community. We're in touch with nature. Look at all the examples of synchrony in nature, bird migrations, anytime the relationship of a mother to her child, the synchronicity of the heartbeats. Synchrony is a deep force of nature, and when we're connected with things, and we are healthy when we negotiate that, successfully negotiate that tension between feeling completely alone and feeling in harmony with nature and with others. So that is the first existential question.
Now, before we go into the next one, let's talk about how things have changed today as opposed to in the past, because I think we have many people that are very alone, but yet it'll show that they have 5,000 Facebook friends. That type of togetherness is not what we're talking about here, what you're talking about. We're talking about real connections with people. So, share a little bit so that the people out there that are getting more into this electronic world are understanding that going out and getting another 1,000 Instagram friends or something is not going to solve some form of illness that you're having because you're feeling lonely.
Yeah, isn't that sad? It's true. People feel that they're not liked. I've met people who get depressed if they find that they haven't gotten a like from somebody, been defriended by somebody. I mean, I don't think most folks. I give people credit. I mean, I think most folks don't need me to tell them that those relationships are superficial and not deeply satisfying. There's a considerable difference between having a soul connection with someone, really feeling heart to heart with someone. You get that in family. Often, sometimes that does not happen, unfortunately, which is when a sense of alienation can occur. But we are deeply alienated from nature, unfortunately, too. And that's a problem of lack of synchrony. If you live in an electronic world, how can you? People are not putting their cell phones aside and bathing in the forest very much anymore, and we're degrading the environment. So there's many, many things tie into this. It's kind of self-evident at one deep level. If you look at my first book, which is Interpreting Chronic Illness, you'll see specifically the illnesses that are associated with failing to resolve the tension between isolation and and synchrony. And some of those things are pretty obvious in psychological terms. You know, depression, for example, or various kinds of heart disease. Yeah, but I give people credit. They know. But the pressures, the societal pressures to be web connected are very strong. People are afraid to do that. I mean, try taking a cell phone away from a 13-year-old. You know, it's a real problem.
Yep, I get it. So what is the second one?
Okay, the second question is, my presence in the world sustainable? And this is the Soric biasm, P-S-O-R-I-C. And this has all to do with the world of metabolism, with digestion. In Chinese medicine, it's the spleen, which is called the spleen. The Chinese idea of the spleen is a metaphor for the entire digestive system. But this is the earth phase in Chinese medicine. And it's the sense dimension, what I call the sense dimension of taste. The first one is about touch. You know, like, are we in touch with people? You know, you touched my heart. Metaphors matter a lot, and they really reveal a lot about that. In the Soric miasm, the key conundrum is between anxiety and challenge. So that's the axis, challenge versus anxiety. And that, whereas the Soric, the first one relates more like to childhood, the second one has more to do with adolescence overall. So we have to be able to, we cannot be afford to be paralyzed by anxiety, and we also shouldn't be reckless in our challenge. The whole digestive system is about auditioning food for its ability to be absorbed. And this is the domain in which we resolve the issue with our parents, where we overcome the challenge of being dependent and becoming independent, and trying to feel okay in the world. When you don't negotiate challenge versus anxiety well, you are prone to anxiety disorders, or you are prone to be reckless, and you're prone to many, many metabolic illnesses. And okay, I go much more into detail on these things in the book. I'm giving you a very quick hit on that.
No, and I appreciate it. And what I'd like to do is to provide an example of myself, and feel free to add some other examples of how we're manifesting these things in our own body. And the example that I give is that, you know, between the ages of like, you know, 9 and 10, my parents were going through a divorce. And by 10 and a half or so, I had ulcers. You know, a 10-year-old should not have ulcers. We should not have that many things to worry about to have ulcers. So let's talk about this, not necessarily just me, but how we're manifesting these things by taking this anxiety and internalizing it rather than having a way to release it.
Yeah. Well, I'm a homeopath, so I would almost be taking your case to answer that. But I'll throw one possibility out. Let's say you need the remedy arsenicum, which is made from arsenic. Mm-hmm. So that's a very important remedy, which also presents itself in the Soric miasm. And people who need that remedy are so incredibly anxious and worried about their circle of love, especially your parents, mm-hmm. That they could readily develop stomach ulcers. And the feeling is, I'd have to go into your case because everybody's different.
Right.
It would apply to you if your ulcers were related to a kind of perfectionism that you were prone to, the feeling like I have very little margin for error, and a feeling of internal restlessness, and having a feeling of burning in the body or the extremities being cold. But the feeling in arsenicum is there's not much time. Something has really upset my apple cart, and I have not, at this level, resolved my anxiety versus challenge. And I'm just tremendously anxious. Any mistake is going to result in the breakage of my circle of love. I'm very worried about my parents. There are other remedies in the Soric miasm. There are other remedies for ulcers which I would talk about if I knew you better, if I was taking your case, you know, but that's an example of it. Yeah. A better example of a soric remedy that I could mention because it's so universal is the remedy Lycopodium clavatum. That's worth talking about. That's all about insecurity. So again, that's a perfect example of anxiety versus challenge. People who need that remedy are very easily intimidated. They feel that interactions have a winner and a loser. They always feel someone's better than them, or they're not ready for something. It pertains to appetite disorders. And here's the existentially interesting thing about lycopodium. It's made from a little moss that grows about 3 inches high. Now, it's a moss, but in primeval times, it grew as tall as a tree. They were actually forests of the lycopodons. But then the gymnosperm trees came along and towered over them, and this moss shrunk itself down through evolution, so made itself very small. And that feeling comes out, is related to what that remedy addresses. And the reason it's so existentially pertaining is because I've never met a single person who is not small, who is not towered over by their parents, towered over by older siblings, and feeling not quite ready. So the keynotes of that remedy, and again, failure to resolve anxiety versus challenge, would be distractibility, being waking up very unrefreshed, always comparing yourself to other people. But the key thing is being paralyzed by a public speaking situation. Can you imagine a more political situation? There's one person standing in front of a big group. Oh my God, they're going to eat me up. I can't deal with this. But the flip side of it is when someone needs that remedy is they become very controlling because they have to, that's their comfort zone. They're either cowards or bully. They ping pong back and forth. So that's a perfect example of somebody who has not resolved anxiety versus challenge. And it's almost universal because we were all small at one time.
So when you talk about a remedy, would it be safe for me to kind of mirror this back that there's actually two things that a person needs to do? It might be this particular substance that will help with the physical problems that are occurring now. But if they're ever truly able to resolve it, don't they also have to deal with the emotional things that are causing it to begin with?
Well, Alan, with homeopathy, it's one-stop shopping. Mm-hmm. The remedy, I guess I should explain that to readers who don't, listeners who don't know. The remedies have basically no materiality. They're incredibly dilute. I mean, if I gave someone a gross amount of this, if they ingested a gross amount of this moss, it would cause the problem. That would be improving. But we count on this paradoxical effect whereby it treats what it causes. The remedy is the substance which has been diluted many, 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 many times, sometimes hundreds of times. And then it prompts a reaction in you at the subconscious level to overcome it. So this is not nutritional supplementation, and this is not therapy. I often share the theme of the remedy with my clients, but I do not have the faith, although sometimes it happens, that my words alone will free them from the problem. But the remedy works magically. It's like a bomb placed deep in the subconscious that when it goes off, changes the environment. The dust settles and the air clears and things are different. People say, "My God, I'm not for somehow. How did you do that? I can give a public speak talk now. I'm not so controlling. I'm not quite as distractible. My digestive problems have improved. I'm waking up refreshed." Although something else will come up underneath that once you peel that onion layer away. But as I say, it's one stop shopping that you don't need separate therapy and, you know, on the one hand and something physical on the other. This is the brilliance of homeopathy.
So Jerry, would it be fair to compare it to old school vaccines where you were given a little bit of something so that your immune system would identify it and build up a point to be able to know how to take it out? Is there a similarity here?
Well, yeah. I mean, homeopaths invented the vaccine.
Yeah,
they did the first version of it. But the difference is there are some substantial differences. First of all, in the modern world with vaccines, you're getting much too much of something, and it's one size fits all. In homeopathy, we're very careful to give exactly the right remedy to somebody, and in a very tiny, tiny, tiny amount. But the original vaccines, Edward Jenner, Samuel Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, were around at the same time, and this idea permeated everything. The first vaccines were much more homeopathic. They didn't contain antibiotics and adjuvants, but the idea of inoculating someone, giving them a small dose of something so they wouldn't get the more serious thing, that is profoundly homeopathic, And homeopaths basically paved, you know, they're the pioneers of this altogether. But in the modern world, where we're throwing antibiotic vaccines at people in these gross amounts with all these substances in them, that's a very different thing. But yes, but the original idea is pretty much the same. Use a tiny amount on a preventive basis. Although with where I practice homeopathy, the existential picture, the emotional, mental emotional picture is much more developed. And we can deal with problems at many, many levels.
So what are some other examples of existentially induced illnesses that are growing in our society right now?
Whoa, good Lord. I don't even know where to start. Asthma.
Okay.
I can't exclude anything. I'd have to give it. I think it would be easier if I kind of go through the five questions, and then we can give examples. Or if you think of something, okay. Then.
Oh, no. I think that's easier. Great if we go through the five examples. But in my mind, What I was thinking of was all of the things that are growing now that, you know, 100 years ago weren't happening at all. You know, so things like Parkinson's and things like this. You know, that, and again, from what I've read from your books, it's literally everything. But I think that if people listening or watching are getting specific examples, they're going to trigger. They're going to trigger and go, oh my God, that's my mom or that's my uncle. Or
Yeah. It will be easier if I do it from within the context of a particular thing question. Here. Let me see if I can give an example. I can go back to the arsenicum example. Okay, I started talking about arsenicum. I'll talk about a certain case.
Okay.
That was just very, made a big impression on me when I was beginning to practice. Would you say that anorexia nervosa could be discussed in this term?
Absolutely.
Okay, so here's a good example. One of my clients told me, oh, can you do anything for my niece, Jerry? She's 13 years old and she's got anorexia. She weighs like 60 pounds. Can you do anything for her? I mean, this is the family, everyone's in despair about it. So I said, well, yeah, why don't you bring her along? Let's see what happens. So this woman convinced her sister to bring this girl to me. So the girl was brought to me and the parents. Parents were pretty skeptical about the whole thing. Anyway, the girl was one of these perfect girls. She got great grades. She was on the gymnastics team. She had nothing but friends. She was absolutely perfect, except she had this terrible delusion that she was too fat, as she was losing weight. All the pathology was involved in this. So I looked at her, and I couldn't get any information about her. But finally, I said, does anything bother you at all? How does your stomach feel? And she said to me, it feels like it's contracting. It's like coming together, my stomach ache. And from that, I deduced something. I mean, understand, I have a fair amount of experience in these sort of things. And I decided that her pathology was related to a delusion in which she wanted to return to the safety of the womb by contracting like this. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, I thought of arsenicum because of the tremendous anxiety that this involved. And I also recognized she wouldn't talk. She wasn't about to talk. So in her silence, she was protecting some kind of family secret. There are things going on in their family she would not talk about. Mm-hmm. And this is how the family ecology was put together. So here's what happened. By the way, that, you know, they were going to throw her off her gymnastics team because she was so sick. She was close to death. Oh. I gave arsenicum. And then, to my amazement, a few weeks later, I find the family is furious at me. They don't want to come back. The girl is eating. The girl is now eating, which I would think would say cause for great rejoicing.
Right.
But she was talking. She was talking, and the things that she was talking about, I did not know, somehow exploded the family ecology, and the family was furious at me because, now, if I had had resources to this, I would have referred her to a family therapist. But she was talking. Now, this whole idea, homeopathy, you know, piggybacks on very commonsensical things. Talking and eating both use the mouth.
Right.
Yeah. So the act of anorexia, not eating, was conformed with her not talking. They didn't come back. The girl's life was saved, but I didn't get any credit for it. Not that that matters. I'm much happier that the girl's life was saved. But it shows you how all things are tied together. In her silence and her not eating, she felt the arsenicum theme, which is to keep her family together. That was how important it was. And it prompted this deep delusion that the only way everything would be safe would be if she retreated to the safety of the womb, closing up like that. And the remedy completely freed her of that. A very instructive story. I did not see her again. But that would be, now again, there's many kinds of anorexia. So that's why I don't want to just talk about diseases. And homeopathy is not diagnosis driven. Why I'm telling you this story is because it had to do with a particular insight I had about this particular girl and how this particular remedy applied. But if you just give remedies like any medicine, cookbook style, because someone has labeled it that way, you're not going to have as much success as if you look at somebody deeply, existentially, and personally.
No, I get it. We're going to take a break, but we will be coming back. And for anybody out there, if you know somebody who's going through something, have them tune in. I think that, they may find out something that they weren't expecting. So again, we are talking with Jerry M. Cantor. We're talking about health, but we're looking at it in a very different way. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're watching or listening to Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practiced lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. We're speaking with Jerry M. Cantor, and he is sharing homeopathic remedies and other things to look at when people are dealing with chronic illness. His latest book is The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness. And so, Jerry, we have a question that has come in. And again, I want to thank those that send in questions either ahead of time or during the show. This one reads, my son is 10 years old and has been diagnosed with autism. The public school he goes to wants to do as little as possible to help. They send him to a speech therapist and seem to ignore his other issues. When I bring up holistic options, they refuse to pay for it. My husband and I are at our wits' end. We have two other children that also need our attention. Any suggestions? This is from Sandra in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Sadly, the autism epidemic really spurred interest in homeopathy over the last 10 years, may I say 8 years. I wrote a book called Autism Reversal Toolbox, which is about the various strategies and remedies that people like myself have used in treating autism. And we have some success with it, working both conventionally and also making remedies from substances that we think are the smoking gun. And there's a huge range of that. And it's such an ridiculously inflamed topic. In fact, my book was censored for a period of time just because it had the word autism in it. We are not living in a particularly free time at this moment. And because of the prominence of that epidemic, it came out of nowhere, seemingly, and the stakes involved, because it's a horrible problem, and it's terrible that it's being normalized. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a lobby that is fiercely going to defend the fact that Roundup is not a problem, that a particular vaccine under certain conditions is not toxic, that something done during pregnancy or by the way, there's no one cause for autism. That's the point I absolutely have to make. And our way of treating is on a very, very individualistic basis. But we get pulled into these controversies, which is why I don't like to talk about it, because the second you say something that you're even that it's treatable, you get into trouble. But we have definitely had results. I've had a couple of cures of it. Most of the time, it's a matter of getting traction. Small differences to in a family where there's an autistic child make an enormous difference. If a child has never spoken and suddenly under the influence of homeopathy is not only speaking but asking questions or making eye contact when he or she never did that before, you know, or eating something that was never eaten before. apart from, it's not the kind of thing that, boom, you wave a magic wand and you cure it. But we do have good results and probably get better results than anybody else, any other kind of practitioner, although we do value all the inputs from the other kinds of therapy. One problem with homeopathy is under attack worldwide, and so the problem is of too few practitioners, too few schools, and way too many clients. I have way more clients than I can handle, and yet at the same time, the attack on homeopathy and the perception in the mainstream public that it's useless, that it's a sham, that it's nonsense, is making it difficult for schools to get traction. So we're at really a crunch at this time. I would love to say, hey, go call your local homeopath, but there just aren't that many of them, especially not that many with skill. But they do exist. And I guess to get a sense of the whole thing, my book, Autism Reversal Toolbox, will give you a sense of the problem and what its scope is and what some possibilities are for treatment.
And I want to add to that also is that it's a topic that I'm also very interested in. And so I went through Jerry's book. Actually, I went through all of his books before he came on here. And as I went through that one, I was very impressed with some of the things that were put in there. And I want to add another thing that you can do. I'm trying to remember the person's name now. I'm going to go back to that. This was Sandra. So Sandra, another thing that you can do, get an educational consultant. You mentioned that your child's in the public school system. Get an educational consultant that can go to bat for you so that when you ask for things that you believe that your child needs, homeopathic or whatever, a good educational consultant can help you get those things and help the school district pay for it.
You know, short of that, Alan, what's kind of become the bread and butter of many homeopaths is children diagnosed with ADHD or ADD. Mm-hmm. And that's not as severe as autism. But the teachers are knowing when the teachers clue into it, they can tell when a child is on a remedy. They know sometimes we get an aggravation, things get worse. But the teachers who are savvy to this recognize that after the aggravation, there's a significant improvement in the child. So stuff like that, if you engage with the teacher and you find a teacher who's not being pressured by the school administration to force medication on your child, you'll do a lot better. And there are schools where I am called in as part of the consultation around the child, and we talk openly, freely about the remedies that are needed and how they're working. But it's, again, the political aspect is that the schools are pressure of the pharmaceutical companies and its partner, the medical profession, is forcing things like Ritalin on children. And this is not good. It's a temporary fix. It doesn't deal with the deeper problem, which homeopathy can do. And there are better ways.
Well, and I agree. And thank you for sharing that, because I think that's a great point is that have a sit down with the teachers and find the ones that that know how to work with that particular situation best. So, again, I think that's great. So, Jerry, as I was doing some of my research, I noticed that there is a Greek god, Sisyphus, that's sort of an avatar for the existential suffering. What would have been a treatment for him when you look at on how this got started?
Yeah, Alan, I wrote about that.
I know.
Yeah, Sisyphus, he is the avatar for this. So he's the guy who pushes the rock up the hill and it falls down. He's got to go and get it again. The remedy that I came up is for him is a remedy called germanium. And the feeling there is that you're just stuck in some kind of routine and you can't get out of it. And you're just going through the same thing over and over and over again. And that's one particular remedy. I mean, I've never treated Sisyphus himself. It would be hard because he's immortal and he's down deep in the bowels of hell. But what he represents, this idea of being in a on a track where you're just not going anywhere, mm-hmm. or he's actually, there's more to Sisyphus than that. He was a very powerful king and a very nasty guy and incredibly ambitious. He actually died several times, and the gods put up with him twice, but the third time they said, no, enough is enough, and they condemned him to this. So part of that theme with Sisyphus is also the theme of reaching too high, you know, and being overly ambitious and being punished. There's another remedy called osmium that the homeopath Jan Schulten, who's a very esteemed colleague, has come up for Sisyphus. I go into that a little bit more deeply in the book because you'll see the physical symptomatology that's attached both to germanium and to osmium. There's a reason why these myths exist. We all relate to them. In fact, the elements of the periodic table very typically are named for, gods that whose mythical story is mirrored in a particular remedy, with often made from the same substance. They were pretty smart, the old myth makers, and they seemed, it's as if they were homeopaths when they named the element, named the, well, the, yeah, when they talked about their gods.
You know, one of the first things you brought up was, people that are lonely or people that are now, not out socializing, they're not out with other people. But I think another thing is that when somebody is suffering, I think they have a tendency to think they're alone or that they're the only one that has this. Can you share with us some of the popular figures, either living or from literature, movies, and about their existential suffering?
One accessible character, also this is a variant of the Sisyphus theme. You have Phil Connors from Groundhog Day. I mean, I thought maybe talk about someone like that.
One of my favorite movies.
Yeah. So let me see. I'll find something about that. I'll tell you about my treatment for Phil Connors.
Okay. So while he's doing that, if you get a chance, everybody out there, to watch Groundhog Day, it's a great Saturday afternoon.
It's a fabulous, film. Movie.
What's that?
Yeah, it is fabulous. So 21 to 22. Okay. Actually, I could also talk about Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. Okay. Well, let's do the Groundhog Day. So the chief protagonist of Groundhog Day is Phil Connors, played by Bill Murray. And that's an existentialist, very much an existentialist story. For no accounting how it happens, he's snared in this deal where he repeats the same day over and over and over again. So the remedy I came up for him was called Gallium Metallicum. And it includes a sense of failure, fear of falling. It's a remedy that comes up for paralysis, for being self-critical. If you remember the character, everybody kind of knows this about him. And Bill Murray epitomizes that kind of person really well. Futile efforts. Physical complaints that are associated with it include cancer, particularly of the bladder or the cervix. A feeling of the eyes being glued together. So this is the sort of thing you would not know just from the movie. But the remedy gallium fits somebody who feels, again, they're stuck in this, something of a variant of the Sisyphus problem. So here's a case I actually had that is maybe more explanatory, parallel to him. You know, a client of mine who had become exhausted and jaded from the rigors of repetitive nursing responsibilities reported her feelings. I'm just barely strong enough to do what I do. It's so very tedious to do four-layer bandage wraps of people. Very tedious. I'm just barely able to do it. I'm experiencing a tremendous amount of anxiety. I'm overwhelmed by all the preparation the work entails. My ears are blocked. I have no desire to eat. This is so unlike me. I've always been masterful at my work. So that's kind of a Phil Connors disease state. So anyway, I gave her a gallium metallicum. And when she returned, I mean, she did not become a generic person. This is real. This is the kind of thing that really happens. Mm-hmm. She reported, well, my ears are unblocked and my energy has come back. But now, as opposed to complaining of barely holding on, she wished only not to be interfered with what she does. So that's also typical, and that's usually a pendulum swing. Something that was really strong in one direction goes not just is not just relieved, but it goes in the opposite direction. And this comes up, you know, almost every time I work with somebody. If a remedy has been powerful, the pendulum swings past the midpoint of its arc, and something opposite comes up. So here, whereas before she was saying she just can't do anything, now she absolutely can do it, but she just her problem is now people interfering with her.
They're slowing her down.
They're slowing her down.
She's on a roll, and she's going to get it done.
Yeah.
You mentioned about hearing and a sort of a blockage. Was that bringing on like a vertigo type of thing, or was that more of something consistent with just not wanting to hear, so sort of blocking out all of the different things that were coming in into her at once?
Wow, maybe you're starting to think like a homeopath, because the remedy does have to cover all these reasons. You know, you never prescribe based on one symptom alone. If someone came and said, my life is absolutely perfect, but my ears are blocked and I couldn't find another thing, I might give a remedy like manganum or something like that. I mean, completely different remedy. But it's never the case, especially if someone's going to come to my office. They have multiple issues. And by the way, I have to do a little bit of excavation, because we get so used to ourselves that very often we don't report the most important thing. And someone will say at the very end of an interview, my brother committed suicide when I was eight years old. But, you know, I'm over that. I mean, but I said, wait a minute, what? We got to talk about that. You know, I've got to figure out what impact that has had. So where was I? I forgot, I lost myself. What did you ask me? The blockage of the ears, the blockage of the ears. So there are in that particular case, so in some way or other, the ear blockage was a peripheral aspect of that Galilean remedy state. Human beings, organisms are very, very complex. So a single issue can have many, many ramifications. You know, like you throw a rock into a pond, all those concentric circles that come out of it. And the trick of it, of being a practitioner, is to figuring out what is key. You know, what is the key thing? Because this is actually what daunts the beginners of homeopathic practice. They don't know where to start. And I've developed a good method for getting really to the heart of things fairly quickly, and deciding what's important and what's at the core of things and what's not. But yeah, you'll find, you know, everything pertains there at some level, but you only make progress if you address the engine of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Now I know you talk about in your books, you talk about Chinese medicine at all, or you talk about Chinese medicine as it relates to homeopathic remedies. Share a little bit as to how you've blended the two to help you come up with some pretty dynamic remedies.
Sure. Well, that's kind of the heart of the book.
That's what I got from it.
Yeah. The five, did I mention what the five core diseases are yet? I think
yeah,
I did.
Yeah, I think I think we got through two of them.
Okay. Well, okay, let me do the third one, which is psychosis, which is, and the existential question is there is, am I oriented in time and space? That's an existential question. Let me see if I can unpack that for you. Yeah. In Chinese medicine, that relates to the element of metal. Mm-hmm. It relates to grief, sadness, mm-hmm. and in physiological terms, to the lungs and the large intestine. Now, if you're an acupuncturist, if someone comes to you with a lung problem, you're automatically going to assume that this person has a grief or a loss. Mm-hmm. It's hardwired. That mind-body connection is hardwired. Or reverse it, if someone has a deep loss, stuck in sadness, you're going to assume that that has some impact on the lungs. And, you know, when we sob, the lungs, you know, the whole lungs kind of shake with it. It's what happens. Now, why time and space? Am I located in time and space? Because if you're stuck in a grief, you're stuck in the past. You haven't used what I call the hacksaw of grief. You have not managed to cut the grief.
Gotcha.
I mean, we are meant to grieve, but to an organic length of time, not too much and not too far. And there's no, by the way, nobody knows what that length of time is. But if we haven't succeeded in resolving the grief and coming to terms with it in some kind of an organic time frame, that causes a problem. We have not resolved the issue of centeredness versus disorientation. So I'm tying all these things together. So this relates to the element of metal in Chinese medicine. In homeopathy, it relates to the disease of gonorrhea. Wow. How I can explain all those connections to you. I'll try, but it's an awful lot. If you actually have gonorrhea, the miasmatic presentation of that is the psychotic, S-Y-C-O-T, not P-S. Psych, and that involves a loss of identity. And the principal remedies which treat that are for people who, they can lose their train of thought. They can be overly just lost in time, have a very poor sense of time. Or if they need thuja, which is the vegetable form of Metarhinum, they have a terrible, terrible self-esteem, and they're chameleons. They have no sense of self. They try to blend in everywhere. And they have all kinds of skin problems. The skin, by the way, is also in Chinese medicine associated with the lungs and the large intestine. It's something that I have to teach you. It's not automatically understood in Western culture. But anyway, so the issue there is centeredness versus disorientation. Another remedy that's involved in that miasm is alumina, which can have a loss of sense of smell. When I figured all these things out, I kind of realized that disorientation and the sense of smell are connected. And quite a while before, it was found that loss of sense of smell was a precedent of Alzheimer's disease. I figured it out sort of philosophically. So this is the sense dimension of smell. And smell, as you know, it completely breaks down time. If you smell a certain cigar, instantly you're back in time when your favorite uncle smoked that particular cigar. Mm-hmm. So all these things are part of what I call the sense dimension of smell. They involve the dichotomy between centeredness, being centered, which involves breathing, right? Being mm-hmm. controlling your breathing, and the opposite is being disoriented. It's a lot to absorb, but I'm trying to answer your question here.
Well, and I appreciate it. I'm looking up. We've got about 2 minutes. When you put it together with Alzheimer's, I'm thinking that, as you're saying, losing the sense of smell, that's one of the things that associates with memory. So is that an indicator that we're starting to lose parts of our memory, and that would be one of the triggers?
Yes, that's right. It's either a promoter or a reflection of the problem. Yeah, and the word disorientation. Yeah, I mean, in Alzheimer's disease, I mean, it's a loss of reference. You know, you hear the phone ring, but you don't no longer know what that means. So the loss of reference, mm-hmm. Who we are, has a lot to do with what we do. You're doing pretty good here, trying to get all this into like this short interview. But if you read the book, it's quite expanded, and you won't feel quite so lost in terms of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and Jerry, first of all, I want to thank you for not only coming on here, but allowing me to, as you said, pack as much as we can in here. I always look at every interview as how can we be value added to the viewers and the listeners, and the more that I was learning about you, as I was pulling up your books, I kept getting more and more questions and more thoughts, and you've just been wonderful. In fact, I'd love to have you back again. In fact, real quick, what's next? Do you have another book coming out?
I have ideas for books, but this one has pretty much all my best ideas. By the way, I'll just tell you quickly the last two existential questions.
Please.
So the fourth one is, can the boundary between life and death be abided? So this deals with two sides of life, death and life. It's pretty deep stuff. And the final one is, has the insurrection of my birth been profitable? So we all have this life when, you know, the world's going on pretty well, and then we come along. And every birth from this standpoint is an insurrection against the status quo. And sometimes maybe it's an issue with some people, maybe it's not. Has their life been worthwhile? Some people say, oh, I'm just going to, you know, drink Pepsi and watch TV the rest of my life. Everything's cool. For other people, this is an important question. The founder of homeopathy, Samuel Hahnemann, has a magnificent memorial in Washington, D.C. And on it in Latin, it says, my life was not in vain. It really mattered to him. And he carried out this enormous insurrection against the medical status quo. So all these questions pertain to people at various times in their life. No one is free of any of them or the charge of any of them. And usually it's at some point in life, one of those really rears its head. And if you don't resolve it, you're prone to get various kinds of illnesses. And that's what this book is about.
All right. His latest book is The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness. But again, I suggest that you Google Jerry M. Cantor, and you will be able to see a variety of different books. And we will have these listed on our site. So if you go to answers.network, we'll make sure that we have listed everything for you. So if you're driving out there, don't feel like you have to write something down. Just know that there's a lot of good information for you. And again, that's Jerry M. Cantor. And Jerry, what's the best website or the best way to be in contact?
Rightwhalepress.com is one. That's my publishing warehouse. But if you just simply Google Sane Asylums, the success of homeopathy before psychiatry lost its mind, go to the Simon & Schuster website or my Amazon page, you'll be clued into all the other connections.
That's great.
But this is about existentialism, this new book.
All right.
Homeopathy for existential stress.
Again, thank you so much. Please, when you have something else come out, let us know. I would love to have you back on. I wish we had another hour.
Thank you very much, Alan. You're a terrific interviewer, and I enjoyed this very much.
Thanks, Jerry. Take care.
Take care.
For everybody out there, be with us. Not just next week. You know, I was going to say be with us next week, but, you know, just go to our website. Check out some of the archives of some of our past shows, or just subscribe to the show. You can do it through Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, and so many other popular podcasts. If you like what you hear, leave a review. It allows us to reach more people. It allows people to quickly look and see if it's something that they want to check out. And the next time you're on Instagram, Facebook, or X, please remember, stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and spread the word. So for everybody, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.